You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Dr. Kat Jarman is my guest. She's the author of River Kings, A New History of the Vikings from Scandinavia to the Silk Roads, which is fascinating reading. Dr. Jarman is an archaeologist, and the stuff she can discover about the past is just astounding. Kat Jarman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, I said you're an archaeologist, but there's got to be more to it. You're some kind of special archaeologist. What are all the things? What are your titles?
Yeah, so I'm a traditional field archaeologist as well. I do go and dig holes in the ground and excavate things. But a lot of my work is in bioarchaeology, which means that I study human remains. And so I look at the sort of chemical signatures, the sort of evidence we can get about past people's lives from their skeletons, basically.
And there's so much that we can learn. I mean, that's the thing that I found so incredible. And it's really like you're a time traveler.
Yeah, it does feel a bit like that, actually, because I think people don't quite realize just how much evidence of our lives that we actually essentially leave without realizing it in our bones and our teeth. And it remains there for thousands of years for us to discover later.
Even what we wore thousands of years later, you've been able to tell things.
Close, sometimes. Yeah, not so much from the bones, but it's more about sort of lifestyle and where you come from, food you ate. But you know, you can reconstruct so much if you take into account the bones and then the grave and material remains. You can really build up a picture of a person in quite some detail, which I find very exciting.
So in terms of the time travel thing, this is kind of sort of fascinating me. Does it make you, because you know so much about what happened 1,000 years ago, does it give you this, don't you want to go 1,000 years into the future and look and see what all happened, how it all...
Well, I think that's almost too terrifying, isn't it? Sometimes do we want to know what's going to happen? Yeah, I think if you do that and then you go back again and you think, no, you have to stop it. But no, but there is something. So, I mean, this was when I was a child. I remember being about 7 or 8 and just desperately wanting to time travel. And I was so upset when I realized that I would never be able to really do that. And I think maybe that's what inspired me to become an archaeologist.
But you've done it. It really feels like you have done it. And I want to get back to that. But let me ask you, what do you think we can learn from your studies of the past in terms of how it affects our current political reality? Because there's a lot of very familiar sounding things in your book.
Yeah, so a lot of things that I talk about are to do with movements and migration. You know, what happens when people move from one place to another and they settle and they stay there? And obviously that's a huge question in our own society politically, and you know, for so many reasons. You know, what happens when people migrate? What happens to language? What happens to culture? And socially, you know, how long are you a migrant? When do you become adopted by that country? And those are the sort of issues that we explore in the Viking Age. So that's certainly one of them. And slightly related to that is those questions of identity. You know, who are you and what makes up your identity? What was a Viking? In fact, actually, nobody really called themselves a Viking at the time so much. But, you know, what does that mean? And what does it mean actually for how we think about it and how we think about the past and who we are? And, you know, the questions about Anglo-Saxons and sort of both Vikings and Anglo-Saxons have been used a lot by far-right extremists to further certain causes. And so it ties in these sort of questions of migration, identity, all of those things, I think, tie in very closely to what we think about today. And I think sometimes looking back at the past can give us a very different perspective. And we need to be careful with that. We need to interrogate it, you know, so that we don't use it for the wrong reasons. But I think sometimes it just gives us a perspective that we wouldn't quite get otherwise.
Well, let me ask you specifically about race. Is race something that more than a construct that we put on people? I mean, do you get what I'm asking you? Is race an actual thing?
Yeah, so I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer that question, to be honest with you. No, I mean, there are physical variations in populations. If you go to towns, I mean, you can see those. It's anything from skin color to sort of face shape and all of those things. Obviously, those are biological realities, but that concept of race that we have isn't one that is just naturally there for us to discover in nature. Now, I should say I'm not a geneticist, I'm not a person who works on this at all, but again, I think we do need to think of that, those concepts, as quite modern. Yes, there are some variations, but they don't map onto what we call races and what we, you know, it's really not. I can't go to a skeleton and go, oh, yeah, here we go. We've got a such and such. You know, they're simply not quite there. But then again, obviously, you have the genetics, you have sort of various genetic markers, things you can look for, but they're not the same. So we need to be really, really careful, I think, with those concepts.
In fact, you can't even necessarily tell the gender of a skeleton.
No, so the looking at just the skeleton, that's not always possible. Quite often it is. But what we really look at is the sort of biological sex, and then the question of gender is a different one. So you can have those arguments as well. You know, just because somebody biologically might be female, if you look at DNA analysis, you can get, you know, the XX or XY, but then what that person was inside. So there's all those questions. We need to sort of, again, be really careful with it and not just sort of add our sort of current assumptions and sort of see, okay, well, what did this sort of mean in that society, which is where it gets really tricky.
Well, it's also interesting, Dr. Jarman, that when you're looking at stuff, you're not only thinking about, you know, what has happened in the 1,000 years, you know, since this person died and was buried, but also what other archaeologists have done with the thing in the meantime that has changed its meaning. I mean, you even found that in the Soviet Union, they would alter history to suit their current political needs.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing we need to remember is that history is something that we write in the present. So whatever our current circumstances are, you know, when we are studying and writing about history, your own time, your own political views, they will all affect how you interpret something. And I think we cannot be objective. It's just completely impossible. History isn't a sort of an objective thing. It's also not the same as the past. The past is sort of what happened, but then history is what we sort of write about it. So if you sort of think of them in those different ways, then yeah, absolutely. And I think when we study history, we need to actually look at what other people, where have you got that information from? So, you know, when the stuff that I was taught as an undergrad at university, I was taught certain things, but that's actually a while ago now, it's about 20 years ago, and things have moved on. So I need to say, well, okay, what were they teaching me? Where did that come from? And sometimes when you start to unravel, it can be quite shocking, actually, because it might come from an initial claim or an initial idea that wasn't really based on any very solid evidence, and then, you know, new evidence has come in. So I think it's really quite exciting. You get these headlines going, history needs to be rewritten, history books need to be torn up and written again, but actually it's an organic thing. We are constantly creating it, so we need to look at that. And yeah, absolutely, the sort of the USSR, the Soviet Union, that's a really prime example of that, because relating to the Eastern Vikings and sort of what they were accepting as a sort of an allowed history and what wasn't. And so that's affected the way we think about the Vikings who traveled to the East to this day.
The idea that we have allowed histories is really frightening, isn't it? But now, you do in your book occasionally tell a story that some other archaeologist had told, and in a completely unsnarky way, you say, but for instance, this person had absolutely no evidence on which to base this story.
Yes.
Legends and stories get told over time, and there's a grain of truth to them sometimes, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there is, but I think that is what you need to unravel. You need to go, okay, where did they come from? What were they looking at? And then I think any of these claims, really, they need to have other things to back them up as well. So, you know, so if person A said this grand statement and this became a popular narrative, if I can go and find other things that back it up, then fantastic, then, you know, person A was probably right. But if everything else goes right against it and that person didn't have any evidence in the first place, you know, that's the process. And I think we sort of, you have to be kind of brave enough, I think, to go back and say, yes, these were great people who wrote these things down, they were professors of this, that and the other, but actually that doesn't necessarily mean that they got it all right. So I think that's what I try to do with the book, try to be a bit brave and say, actually, okay, can we still support this? And some cases, yes, others, no.
Well, now, I can see you. My listeners can't, but you're just, have you encountered, you know, well, you're just this little girl. And these were men who knew what they were talking about because they were men. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so surprisingly not, actually. I know that lots of women, lots of younger women who do this sort of thing do. Maybe I've just ignored it. I've had one or two, you know, some sort of alpha male scientists have sort of tried to go, no, don't make those claims. And I tend to just ignore them and do my thing anyway. I think if you have enough confidence, then you can do it. But I know that for many women, especially, that is difficult. And you do have to be really brave and you have to push, you know, your elbows out a bit and go, you know, no, I can do this. I can say this. But as long as you've got the evidence, you can back it up and be scientific about it, that people do listen. So I think, you know, so my message to the listeners out there who are maybe younger women wanting to go to science, wanting to do this sort of thing, just go for it and just sort of be confident in it. Because I think if you do say things and you back it up, then people do listen, no matter what you look like.
Well, you look great. And it turns out that Wonder Woman is not the most far-fetched movie ever made. I mean, according to you, there were a lot of warrior women and they...
Yes. So this is an interesting one. We do have some evidence that women took part in military roles, what we would commonly call warriors in Viking Age society. So, I mean, I think we have to take it with a little bit of a pinch of salt. So if you see some of the drama series, if you watched, you know, Netflix Vikings or anything like that, you have these big hordes and grand armies of just women. And it seems like you could just choose to pick up a sword and fight if you're a woman. That's not quite true. But we do have archaeological evidence, definitely, that there were women who were fighting. They're, you know, buried with weapons. There's lots of stories in the sagas as well and in other accounts of women being part in that sort of military sphere. So absolutely, there was a reality for some women in the Viking Age.
And the bones tell you how a person died sometimes, and if they died in battle or if they were simply massacred or tortured or something like that.
Yeah, occasionally. It's actually not that common because we need to then have some very sort of severe, really, injuries. So the injuries need to have gone through, you know, flesh and blood and gone into the bone. And that actually doesn't happen as often as we might think. That's the first sort of thing that needs to have happened, but then also the bones need to be well enough preserved so that you can actually see that evidence. So it's not as common as we would have thought, but we do have some quite spectacular cases of injuries, and sometimes we can even reconstruct what type of weapon, because some of the weapons leave very distinct cut marks on the bones, and then you can sort of match that up with weapons that we have in the archaeological record, which is quite fascinating. It's a bit CSI, basically. CSI Vikings.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro, and my guest this week is Kat Jarman. Her new book is called River Kings, A New History of the Vikings, From Scandinavia to the Silk Roads. Kat Jarman, your study of bones of the Vikings uncovered the story of a very violent, evil woman who killed a whole bunch of people.
Oh, yeah. So you're thinking about Olga now, Olga of Kiev.
And
yes.
Still revered.
Yes, that's right. So she sort of becomes this saint who's sort of the key to the church later on, because she converts to Christianity in Ukraine, actually. But her backstory is quite bloody and gruesome. She takes revenge on her husband's death. So her husband was the king and he was murdered. And to take revenge, she goes quite wild, actually, in the killing off all her enemies.
And how much of that story, which is a great one, was written, and how much can you discern of its truth from archaeology?
So that particular story, we don't have any archaeological evidence for it being true at all. So, and I think some of it, you know, if you read it, if you sort of think back on the way you were taught English literature at school, maybe how you're sort of analysing a text and the story, you can see that there's a lot of embellishments. There's a lot of things, you know, repetition, things happen three times and all of that, which is clearly sort of literary sort of tools, I suppose. So I think that in itself suggests to us. But also within that sort of mindset and within the things that we know happened from other sources in that society at the time, it's not implausible at all. So I think that's where we need to go. You know, so for a massacre like that to take place, it's actually quite likely. You know, we have evidence of massacres. We have here in England, there's an 11th century, so contemporary with this particular Algonquin, a massacre of 50 likely Vikings actually killed by Anglo-Saxons, and they're all in a massacre. They're all decapitated. It's horrific, but you know these things do happen. So it's not beyond, you know, imagination for it to have been real.
So let me ask you this personal thing about looking at this kind of stuff. I mean, when we pick up a rock or a thing, you know, it's like, it's a thing. But when you pick up a bone, that's a thing that was, and sometimes when we see bones in art and so on, or what about that? I can't remember exactly, but in France, I've been to this place where it's just an entire cathedral made of bones underground. Like every time you pick up a bone, you know, that's an individual. And do you get, is it ever creepy or sad or...
Yeah, it's a really interesting feeling, actually. And I do take great care when I do this, when I work with human remains, not to just become blasé about it. Because, you know, it's something you pick them up and it feels like a twig, you know, a bone feels like a twig. And you have to remember this was a real person who lived and loved and who had people who hopefully cared about him or her, and maybe a sort of tragic end to their lives. You just don't know. So you have to sort of remember that these are real people that you're dealing with. I don't find it scary or creepy in any way at all. Although I have to say the first time I ever really looked at sort of a large collection of bones. So I was given access to the cellar at the University of Oslo of the anatomical collections that have 9,000 skeletons. It was all early in the morning, 8 o'clock. I was on my own. I was given the key, going down these metal stairs to a basement with just sort of flickering lights. And the bodies and the skulls are separated. So all the skulls are upstairs and all the bodies are downstairs. So you had these cavernous of sort of 8,000 heads staring at me all on my own. And the door slammed shut behind me. And that was the closest I've got to be sort of creeped out. But actually, I'm not superstitious. I don't believe in any sort of spirits or ghosts or anything like that. I do find it really fascinating. It really reminds you of humanity that, you know, each of these was a person alive that lived with a story that probably never know. Maybe some of the work I do can sort of try to put some of those stories back. But you know, it sort of brings you close to what it means to be a human being, I think. So I find it quite a sort of, it's quite a touching thing.
It's incredibly fascinating, and the stuff that you learn. I mean, like, you can tell, you were able to tell from where people came by the water they drank and the food they ate. How does that work?
Yeah, so this is one of my favorite parts, actually, because we are essentially just like walking diaries of our lives. So all the time we're eating and drinking, and the food that we eat and the water that we drink essentially becomes the building blocks to all our tissues. So our skin, our hair, our nails, they're all grown from what we eat and drink. And with that, little chemical signatures, so sort of differences, oxygen from the water, for example, or hydrogen from the water that we drink, becomes part of the hair. So you can analyze that hair on your head, and then you can actually look at those different chemical signatures, and they're different in different parts of the world. So you're in California, so you've got a much warmer climate, you've got really different chemical signatures in the water that you drink to the water that I drink. So that sort of also passes then on to our hair and skin and whatever. And so you can sort of plot it, and you can look at, you know, does this fit with somebody from California, or does it actually fit with someone from a really cold climate? And the magical thing is that in human teeth, these are formed in childhood, and then they stay, nothing changes. Your tooth enamel just stays the same. So whatever you ate or drank, and the place you ate and drank that in, is essentially locked into your teeth forever and ever and ever. So I live in England now, but I grew up in Norway. So my teeth have got the sort of Norwegian cold climate signatures in them, basically. And when I die and my body is in the ground for 1,000 years, that signature is going to be the same. So an archaeologist comes along in 1,000 years, they will then be able to look at my teeth and go, oh, we have a migrant. And I think that's very special.
Well, do you think that your colleagues 1,000 years from now will have a harder time with that, because the world is such a much smaller place now and people move around so much more freely? It's not such a big deal about moving from one place to the other.
Yeah, we do move an awful lot, actually, and it's sort of quite quick and quite easy. But I think actually in the past, people did also move much more than we thought. And we tend to have this idea that people just would stay put and you couldn't really go very far. But I think things like looking at the Vikings especially, that's really a time when sort of the world kind of opens up. And you have these people who come out from Scandinavia and they go all the way to the Middle East and they go all the way to Britain, to Greenland, to Iceland, to North America. And actually really quite quickly and easily. So I think we do need to be careful to think that, you know, people in the past didn't do that so much. So it's kind of already confusing, yeah. I should say.
We're talking with Kat Jarman, and her book is called River Kings, A New History of the Vikings from Scandinavia to the Silk Road. I want to know, a lot of people today are obsessed with gaming, and they take it very seriously, but apparently... Yeah. 1,000 years ago, they were obsessed with gaming and they took it very seriously.
Yes, absolutely. It's nothing new. I mean, maybe the format's slightly different, but no, we do, especially in the Viking Age, we find a lot of gaming boards and especially gaming pieces. So they're games, the one that seemed to be really popular, it's a bit like, it's a kind of almost a bit like chess or checkers. And it's a game called Hneffeltafel that they seem to play an awful lot. And we know this because we find these little gaming pieces all over the place and they're in graves, some beautiful examples of sometimes made of glass or metal or bone carved intricately. And then we said the sort of throwaway ones, a bit like playing cards, you know, you can just get a sort of rough and ready set of deck of cards that you just take with you. We get those as well on really quite large proportions on Viking sites, which is amazing. And again, it just brings you back to that idea of being human. You know, we're all the same. Even 1,000 years ago, if you had a really boring 2-week journey across the ocean on a ship, you've got to entertain yourself. So you're playing games.
Tell us the name of the game again.
Hneffeltafel.
Hneffeltafel. Do you know how to play it? Do you know how it was played?
Yes, I do. I'm not very good at it. But so you've got two teams and you've got a king and you've got to sort of try and get the king. So similar to sort of games like chess, I suppose, in a way.
And have you ever killed anybody to whom you lost the game? No, you never.
Well, not that I can mention. No. I never lose, obviously. No. I haven't gone quite that far.
but apparently there was killing involved occasionally.
Yeah, it seems to, at least from some of the saga stories, it seems to be that serious. But we also see them, you know, they associated with military context as well. So it seems like it's got to do with strategy. And again, like, I suppose things like chess is obviously a strategy game. So there is a sort of military type link there as well to those games.
I want to ask you about animals. Did people have pets 1,000 years ago? And what about horses? You mentioned briefly horses, but tell me more. What do you know about animals there?
Yeah, absolutely. So they had a lot of pets, I think, actually. Horses were very important. Horses were important for obvious reasons. You don't have cars, and so to go across land, you do need your horses. And the horses were very, very valued. They quite often, we see them being taken with somebody taking them with them into death as well. So in graves, we see people being buried with horses. So the horses are sacrificed, presumably then to join the person in the afterworld. Probably. So we have a lot of that. But we have also things like dogs. Dogs are very common in the Viking Age, actually. So people have dogs as pets, probably also for hunting. And then you see some occasionally rarer things. There's even evidence of a peacock somehow having made it to Norway. We don't have wild peacocks at all, so it's presumably a traded item. Again, in a grave, there's just lots of peacock feathers, and sometimes sort of other wild birds as well, like falcons, for example. Falconry was clearly a sort of high status thing in the Viking Age.
And a peacock feather would survive 1,000 years in a grave, apparently?
Not always. It's quite rare, but occasionally we have some wonderful graves from Scandinavia that have had, that we've been really lucky that they've got really great preservation, so something like that has remained, which is wonderful.
And do the bones of those animals tell you, oh, they brought this horse with them all the way on a ship? And
Yeah, so they can do. So we haven't got too many studies of it yet, but exactly the same thing works for animals as well. So there's some really interesting questions. We're only really starting to pick this apart now and see what people are doing. But there's certainly some evidence. There's a grave in which I write about in the book in Salme in Estonia, where there's some disastrous attack on this group of men. So they're all buried in a ship there, and they have dogs with them, and those dogs come from the same places as the men.
Now, horses, did they shoe them? I guess if they did, you would know.
Yeah, we get horseshoes. So we do see those, and that's one of the things. So I also run excavations at the site of Repton that I write about, one of their Viking camps in Derbyshire in England, and we have had a couple of horseshoes from there from the right period. So that's, again, you might not have the horse, but you have the shoe.
Well, that's pretty interesting that they shoed horses 1,000 years ago. It's not just some kind of newfangled thing that people thought of.
No, absolutely. Clearly, they realized quite quickly that this was a useful thing to do.
Interesting. It's amazing. Now, talk a little bit about, Dr. German, talk a little bit about slavery. You encounter a lot of it, and I guess there's, well, I'll just let you tell me something.
Yeah. Absolutely. So we do know that slavery was a big part of the Viking world. We know that for a lot of reasons. We know that mainly from written sources. So there's a lot of textual evidence for that. And in fact, especially, so I write particularly about the Eastern trading routes. So going down Eastern Europe through what is now Ukraine and Russia and down to Constantinople, which is now Istanbul, and also going beyond to Baghdad. And there was a huge demand for slaves in those Eastern markets. So the Vikings, or more commonly known as the Rus in these eastern territories, were really taking advantage of this. So they were bringing vast numbers of slaves down those eastern rivers. In fact, the very word slave comes from the Slavs. So the Slavs were the people who were living in those territories because they were taken in such great quantities. So that's why we've got the word from. That doesn't to say that they didn't invent slavery. That wasn't where it comes from. But the English word that we use comes from the Slavic people.
Right, because there was slavery
Yeah,
thousands
so
of years
they're
before that.
taking, yeah,
Yeah, but
the slaves.
how was it determined who would be a slave? Was there a yeah.
We don't know, actually, is the honest truth to that. There's a lot we don't know about the slave trade, partially because we don't have the human remains. It's really difficult to prove that somebody was enslaved. So we do have a few written records, but not many. So it does seem like a lot of people were captured. We also know that when that trade was taking place, so in the Muslim world, for example, that you couldn't take other Muslims as slaves. So you needed people of other religions, which is makes it quite profitable. So you could see someone like the Vikings coming in to take an advantage of that, and taking people who are not Muslims, and then selling them on to places like Baghdad. And I think similar things happened other places as well, but it's just one of those things we don't have records. So there's a lot of tragedies, there's lots of sort of lives there that we will just never know about.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro, and my guest this week is Kat Jarman. Her new book is called River Kings, A New History of the Vikings, From Scandinavia to the Silk Roads. Dr. Jarman, did the ancient peoples that you're studying use the same place names for places that we use today?
Yeah, so we've got a lot of place names that survive, and especially in England, and that's really, really interesting because you can actually look at Scandinavian settlement in England through the place names, and once you know, if you then drive around England, it's quite fascinating. So things like anything ending with a BY, so things like Derby, Rugby, any place names like that, which we have a lot of, that's a Scandinavian ending. We've got another one which is Thorpe. So Scunthorpe, for example, is a place, and that Thorpe bit again is a Scandinavian one. So these really suggest that these were places where Scandinavians settled, and then we've got them all over the country.
Well, that's pretty interesting. And what about language? I mean, what language did these people speak mostly? Or were there
my dog movement? In the background. Sorry,
is that your dog?
Sorry. Yeah. Speaking of pets and dogs. So languages. Yeah. So languages that the Vikings and Scandinavians speak, it's essentially called Old Norse. So the Norse, that's the root of what now becomes then the Norwegian, Swedish, Danish, also into Icelandic. That's also very closely based on Norse. So these were the languages. So we've got quite sort of good knowledge of what was spoken. And then those languages also had an impact on a lot of the places where they settled. So English language, for example, has an awful lot of Old Norse elements to it. So things you probably don't know, but words like egg, sky, knife, even cake, these are all Old Norse words. So they came with the Vikings into the English language because of that settlement and that movement.
I've heard of cake.
Ah, good.
My favorite. I like cake. I've been to Iceland. Tell me a little bit about Iceland. How did people get to Iceland, and who are those people? And
yeah, so Iceland is a really interesting one because in the Viking Age, it was essentially empty. So whereas everywhere else the Vikings went, more or less, you know, some of them went to try to invade France, not quite successfully, apart from Normandy, Britain and Ireland. These are places where people lived already. Iceland was more or less empty. There's possibly a few sort of hermit religious people there, but essentially it was completely empty. So they go, a lot of them we know go from Norway because there are various later records. And it's not that difficult to get there. It's quite straightforward. I mean, these, you have to remember, these are exceptional seafarers, the Vikings, and they have some really incredible ships and boats. So it's not a very long journey. So some go directly there and settle. Others go via Britain. And so they might settle in Britain first and then go across, or they might sort of stop off en route. And there's a lot of debates over where they're mainly men coming from Scandinavia, whether they are taking slaves with them, whether they're taking women with them. And actually the evidence, again, looking at the science and looking at those trackers and sort of signatures for migration, also looking at DNA, is suggesting, there's one early study suggested that it was mainly Norwegian men taking Celtic, so Scottish and Irish women with them. Now there's some new evidence saying maybe it's not that clear, but clearly there is a mix there. So we have people from Scandinavia and from Britain and Ireland as well.
Yeah, Iceland must be an interesting study because the population is so small.
Yeah, there's 300,000 people living on Iceland today, and actually They've done a lot of DNA work, so they have almost the entire population's genetics mapped. So it's there's a lot of interesting studies coming out of there.
Well, I have an Icelandic horse. And when I was in Iceland, I told this Icelandic horse breeder my horse's name, and she looked it up on her phone. And she knew exactly everything about this horse and all the horses that came before. So.
Fantastic. Well, I've also heard that there's an app where you can check how related you are to someone, which is sort of used for dating. So if you meet someone in a bar, you might want to just double check.
Make sure they're not
you're not too closely cousin. Related. Yeah. Especially when you've got a very small population, that might be useful.
Yeah, I can see why. Now, the Vikings did not have any apps on their phones.
Not that we know of, no. Maybe they had sort of tablets and runic inscriptions and something like that instead. I don't know.
Well, how you mentioned yourself as a little girl. How did you get into this and go so far with it?
Yeah, I think it was actually going to museums was one big thing. So I grew up in Oslo. And we have these fantastic museums, and one of them is the Viking Ship Museum, where we have three big Viking ships that were buried as graves. And these are enormous. These are sort of 20 meters long, and they are staggering. And I still remember going in there, so completely sort of hair standing up on my back, because here was this ship that was buried in the ground more than 1,100 years ago. I could reach out and touch it, and there would be a direct connection. This was the one who wanted to time travel. So right. I couldn't do that, but you know, I could touch this ship, and somebody else, another little girl, could have touched that 1,000 years ago. So that really sort of sparked my imagination. And I read some novels set in, you know, Viking Age when I was a child as well. And then I realized, you know, there was this opportunity out there to do that. And I realized how much we could still learn. And you know, it was all about people, the people in the past. And that I think just really completely sparked my imagination. And when I went to university and then learned about all the new science and how we can actually apply all these new methods, and there's so much more you can say. I used to sort of think, well, you know, it is all written, history is all written, but when you realize it's not, and you can use new methods, you can actually make a big contribution. Then, that was that really. I was lost lost to the archaeology.
Well, your passion for it really comes through in your book, River Kings: A New History of the Vikings from Scandinavia to the Silk Roads, Cat German. And it seems to me that this is just the first of several volumes. You have another book in the works. Will there be another
one? Yeah, I've just literally come now from my desk, where I've been banging my head against my desk trying to get somewhere with the next one. It's a hard stage now. So yeah, I am working on my next one. It's definitely something that I'd like to do more of, because it's a really nice way of getting these ideas out to people. And actually, for my own selfish reasons, I get to sit and read and write and enjoy it. So
is it a thing where you're able to take all that you've learned and kind of organize it in a different way by writing a book about it?
Yeah, you do, because you suddenly have to put it into a narrative. You know, this has to make sense to someone like you, and you might not have the background. That was not what I meant. Somebody who doesn't have the 20 years of working on it that I have, but actually somebody who just come to it and maybe picked it up and have a couple of hours after work to read a book. And it's got to be engaging, it's got to be interesting, it's got to make sense, you have to have enough. So that is such an interesting challenge, because it's like, okay, what is the story you're telling? How are you telling it? But actually, you know, it's not just fiction, it's not pretend, but actually you're trying to do something, sort of convey some really quite important information at the same time. So it's a really interesting challenge, and it allows you also to go back and reassess and say, okay, well, what have people said before, and is that the story I still want to tell now? So it is a really, really interesting process.
Well, I really loved it, and I'm looking forward to another one. And when there is another one, will you come back and chat with me again?
Yes, absolutely. I've just got to write it first.
You write it. I'll read it. That will be our job.
Perfect.
Do the writing, I'll do the reading. River Kings: A New History of the Vikings from Scandinavia to the Silk Road, by Dr. Kat Jarman. Dr. Jarman, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.